Welcome to the Third Producer Profile with the legendary California winemaker Randall Graham, founder of Bonnie Doux Vineyard and Pomplushun. Randall is possibly best known for his pioneering work with Rhone varietals in California in the 70s, giving him the name of the original Rhone Ranger. Graham is a constant innovator and envelope pusher. Among his many accolades is the promotion of screw caps on premium wine, one of the first to use micro-oxygenation in California, to then stop using it, and the use of ingredients on wine labels. He has inspired many other producers of California. In this episode, we talk about his early days as a winemaker, exploring their own varieties, why he supported screw caps, and what varieties he sees growing in California. Also, we talk about his latest project, Pomplushun, where he's looking to create the ultimate terroir wine by having thousands of naturally intercrossed vines in a single vineyard. Truly one of the most inspiring and inspired winemaker on the global scene now. Hi, I'm Mattia Scarpazza, and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, processes, and concepts that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey looking into wine. Welcome to Looking Into Wine. Today's guest is Randall Graham, founder of Bonnie Doux and proprietor of Pomplushun. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wanted to start maybe a couple of questions of the beginning. And I know you wanted to start in the early 80s to make some great Pinot Noirs, and that didn't work out. And then you moved to Syrah. Why did you decide to go for Syrah? And was it difficult to work with Syrah back then?
It was. I mean, I actually came to Syrah and Grenache simultaneously. In other words, I started with Pinot Noir, and my results were very poor in my vineyard in Santa Cruz Mountains. And I wanted to continue in the wine business, but I didn't really know exactly what direction I wanted to go. And it was actually very lucky for me that I met Kermit Lynch. I was a customer of Kermit Lynch's back then. And Kermit was very keen on varieties of southern France. He said, well, you should try them in California. And the reality is nobody knew much about these grapes. Nobody knew what kind of conditions they needed, how they grew. I mean, everyone, for example, misunderstood Syrah. They thought Syrah was a warm climate grape. They of course, had never been to Côte Rôtie and knew how bloody overcast it is all the time. In fact, nobody really knew much at all about Rhone varieties. So it was new territory. It was really just an intuition on my part that they would do well in California. But it's definitely been a learning curve since then.
Absolutely. And you decided to make your first wine, signature wine. It was the Cigar Volant.
Correct.
Which was a blend of these grapes. And there is a funny, interesting story about the name and a bit the evolution of the wine as well.
Yes. You know, in other words, so when I saw that Pinot Noir was not going anywhere for me, I decided I needed to take another direction. And it was largely intuition. I thought, you know, probably none of these grapes in California are planted in exactly the right place. Probably most of them are planted in the wrong place. But maybe I thought, my intuition was, maybe if I blended them together, I could compensate for any of the defects or deficiencies of any of the individual grapes. And in fact, the Grenache was much more interesting than anything else. The Syrah that I first began to work with was planted in an extremely warm area east of Paso Robles. And there were only, I think, four or five Syrah vineyards in California at the time. And all of them were dreadful in their own unique way. And I found the least dreadful one of them. And I thought, well, you know, I better not put too much Syrah in this because it's not that great. But the Grenache really carried the day, and the Mourvèdre did as well. There was brilliant Mourvèdre in California. So that's how I ended up with Cigar Volant. And as far as the name, I think you were kind of inquiring about how it came to be called Cigar Volant. It seems, this is a true story, in fact, that in 1953 and 54, there were a lot of sightings of UFOs in North America and in Europe. And some people got very concerned about this, including the mayor of one of the villages in Châteauneuf, who proposed an ordinance prohibiting the landing of UFOs and cigares volants and soucoupes volants in the vineyards. And of course, the ordinance has worked perfectly, as none have landed since then.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's still around, that law, apparently. So.
It is, yes.
And, I mean, you can, you know, the names, experimented a lot over the years with the names and the branding. It was very much something you push forward. Why did you thought that it was so important for your wines to have a very good labeling?
Well, I think it's important for any wine to have a good package, but I think especially important when you work with new categories of wines that are unknown to people. You have to find, as we say, a hook to kind of bring them in. And the thing that was important to me, at least, again, I never took any marketing courses or business courses, but I understood that I wanted to contextualize the wine for them, give them a point of reference so they can understand what, maybe a little bit about the style of the wine. But then the key thing is, you don't want to come off as being a copycat. You don't want to come off as being a second best. So the wineries that call their wines, I wanted to reference the French Chateau Neuf du Pape, but I didn't want to call my wine Chateau quelque chose or Domaine de n'importe quoi, because that seems pretentious and stupid. And forgive me, but I did. So I wanted a French name, but with an ironic twist. So I wanted to, you know, other wineries insist on a minimum amount of iron in their wine. I insist on a minimum amount of irony in our wines. So I wanted to have a slightly offbeat name and something memorable. And, you know, the problem, of course, is if it's too goofy, then you're not taken seriously. If the wine is too off the wall, if the package is too off the wall, the wine is not taken seriously. And that's always the risk that you run when you use humor on your wine.
Also, I think your newsletter made into a book, and they were memorable. A lot of people have talked about them. And I think also the fact that over the years you experimented so much in your vineyard and your wines. And there was some experiment with Demijohn or the glass barrel. What was the thought behind that?
Well, it's a little complex, but, you know, we did some very interesting work with Demijohn. It's a very powerful technique, because what it does is it changes the surface area to volume ratio in the wine. So there's a lot of opportunity for lees to get digested into the wine. Lees, which are the yeast cells that fall to the bottom of the vessel, are powerful, and they're kind of, I think of it as like the conscience of the wine. So in other words, you can have a good conscience or a bad conscience. So it's like the demiurge. It's like a little devil or angel that sits on your shoulder, and it can be either good or bad. So if it's, use it for good, it's positive, but it can also take over the wine as well. So you don't want to have it devour the wine. You want to use it as an ally rather than as a contrary force.
Absolutely. And at some point, I know you were producing some very astounding number of wines, like 20 cuvées at the same time.
More, maybe like 30 or 35. Wow. It was ridiculous.
What was the wine that you were surprised the most, like the one you thought, wow, this is amazing?
Well, you know, the estate vineyard, one of the lessons I've learned, and I'm not sure exactly how to state the lesson precisely, it's that your intellect can only take you so far, and your intuition often is more useful than your intellect. So, for example, the things that I decided to plant in Bonny Doon in the Santa Cruz Mountains, great reason to do it, but they just worked. I planted Syrah in the Santa Cruz Mountains and made an incredible estate Syrah. I planted Marsan, and I planted Roussan, which turned out not to be Roussan, but arguably the wine we made from that, which we called Le Sophiste, was probably the most interesting wine I ever produced. And I didn't even know, I wasn't even aware of the correct grape variety I was using. So things just sometimes have a way of taking care of themselves. Sometimes, and sometimes they don't.
Yeah. Well, as everything, when experimenting, some of them works. But I know then one of the experiments, it was when he also was with dry rosa, which turned out now to be a good product, then something very very popular.
Oh, yes. We love rosé, and been working with it since 1981, dry rosé, and finally got the hang of it. I mean, after 35, almost 40 years. I'm still working on it, and I'm very keen on, there's a variety in France called Tiburin.
Okay.
In Italy, they call it Rossese, mm-hmm. in Liguria, which I'm sure you know. Yeah. And that I think is a fabulous potential for rosé.
Okay.
So I think we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of what's possible for pink wine.
Absolutely. I mean, also I think did you get the idea to make a dry rosé through your traveling to France and Europe? And I know you had a lot of influence throughout the years with Europe.
You know, to be frank, I don't even remember. But I'll say yes.
Okay.
I mean, I know Kermit was and is a great fan of Domaine Tempier. So I did drink a fair bit of Domaine Tempier at a young age. But honestly, I can't even remember what first drew me to
pink wine. Possibly that. I mean, back then, probably it was most, especially in California, there was a lot of medium, meat sweet rosé.
Yes, something. Yikes.
Yeah. It was a bit off the beaten track, a dry rosé, I would say. And when talking about the experiment, you recently decided to open a new winery in San Juan Batista. Where is that, and why in that area? It's called Pop du Chum,
the winery. Pop du Chum. Well, so far it's not a winery; it's just a vineyard. And San Juan Batista is in a very small county called San Benito County. So it's not too far from Santa Cruz, where I live. It's about 50 minutes southeast of Santa Cruz and about 12 miles south of Gilroy, the town of Gilroy, and about six miles west of Hollister. So, but San Juan Batista is a small town. It's most famous for its mission. It has a beautiful mission, I think the most beautiful mission in California. And it's a largely agricultural town. Mm-hmm. Very few grapes, not a lot of vineyards. Calera Winery is probably the best known winery in San Benito okay. County, which is not far. However, what's interesting about San Benito County is the geology and the seismology. We get earthquakes. The San Andreas Fault borders our property. The northernmost boundary of our property is the San Andreas Fault. So we have a lot of interesting geological or seismic activity, and that gives us some very interesting soil types over the years.
Wow. And so you're running your 10,000 grapes project?
Yes.
What is it and how?
What could possibly go wrong?
what is it then?
Well, we have two big projects. The first project is more straightforward, and that is what I call varietal auto-tuning. So those are self-crosses. So for example, there's a variety that we like, but it's not perfect. It's got some problems, and we want to fix it. We let it pollinate itself, and then the results, most of the results are not interesting, but a few small percentage are more interesting. So that's a way of correcting, let's say, tragic flaws in wines, or finding a particular biotype or variant that is better suited to our site than mm-hmm. it was than the original parent. So, for example, we're working with an antique clone of Syrah called Serene,
okay,
which is from Côte Rôtie, and obviously Serene is very well adapted to Côte Rôtie, but not necessarily well adapted to San Juan Batista. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for the particular biotype or biotypes that seem to be better adapted to ripen at the right time, that have the right chemistry, that have the most flavor intensity mm-hmm. under our conditions rather than their original conditions.
Absolutely. So you're aiming to create something that is unique to your area. That's I take as the aim of the project, that particular project.
that particular project. So that's pretty straightforward, and we're doing this with a couple of grape varieties. But the more ambitious project, or as ambitious, is breeding new varieties from two strains, from two parental lineages. And so these create new grapes completely from scratch, that nothing like them that has ever existed before. And this is either a really good idea or a really bad idea. And but there's basically two bets we're making. Mm-hmm. We're trying to achieve two possible outcomes. Well, there's actually an infinite number of outcomes, but the two bets that I'm making are, one is the following, that if you breed 10,000 new grapes, among the 10,000, there's going to be several that are interesting.
Okay.
Now, it begs the question, what is interesting, and what are you looking for, and how do you know that you found it? Because these are unusual, these are new grapes that have never existed before, and how do you know that you found something brilliant? Immediately. It may take several years. You may overlook it. So it kind of gets to the question of what is quality in wine? What is beauty? How do you know you found a beautiful grape? So that's one. And that's something that I may never achieve. Now, maybe when I'm gone, if the vineyard is still in existence, someone will have developed very powerful algorithms in their computers to detect beauty or detect complexity or detect quality, whatever that is in the abstract. But they may be after I'm gone. But the more interesting result would be to look at what happens, what kind of wine you produce when you make a wine that is composed of a very large set of genetically distinctive individuals. Where, in other words, your vineyard is genetically unique. Every plant is genetically different from every other plant, all in the same family, all related to one another. So there's a familial relationship, but they're all different. Some are going to be red, some are going to be white, some are going to be pink. And then you have to figure out how to use these. And what I'm betting on, what I'm thinking is interesting, is this strategy works as a means for expressing soil characteristics. So in other words, what you're doing by creating such a complex blend, you are effacing varietal characteristics. You're diminishing the varietal characteristics in such a way that the soil characteristics can emerge. And so my very radical hypothesis, and I don't know if I believe this all the time, but I believe it some of the time. My belief is that if you have a very strong terroir, a very expressive terroir, you could probably plant a lot of different grape varieties and still produce an interesting wine, even if the grape varieties themselves are maybe less than brilliant themselves. I think they're just act as a carrier to express soil characteristics. And I think this is true because of the evidence of some fairly neutral grape varieties that don't really have a lot of complexity on their own under other conditions, things like Chasselas, Swiss grape Chasselas, or the grape Mission, the Mission grape, which is or Listan Negro, which is related to the Mission grape. These are all pretty neutral grapes, but under certain kinds of strong terroir, they can produce very complex wines.
Okay, so you're trying to make it that is the soil speaking for the making the most of the Tolkien. Through the wines.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And you were talking, we wanted to talk about the Picolet, which is a free-run grape variety.
Yes.
And how that does fit in.
Oh, yes. Yeah, thank you for reminding me. So I've given some thought and some meditation as far as what the parents want to be. And I've decided one needs to be a red grape and one needs to be a white grape. And I'm trying to figure out qualities I'm looking for under our conditions. And some of the things I'm looking for are drought tolerance and ripening within a certain epoch and upright growth, because I don't want to use wire and trellis. And I seem to find the grapes that are upright growing tend to be more vigorous and more drought tolerant. This seems to correlate. Now, as you know, when you create a new grape variety, it's a very tedious process, and grapes are hermaphrodite. Most vinifera, 99% of vinifera grapes are hermaphrodite. So grape can be a male, a female, or a hermaphrodite. So hermaphrodites set their fruit generally pretty reliably. Male grapes don't set fruit at all. They don't produce any fruit. Female grapes will only produce fruit if there's male grapes or hermaphrodite grapes nearby. So in Friuli, for example, with picolite, if you just planted a vineyard of picolite, you wouldn't have any fruit. You have to interplant it or pollinate it with another grape for it to produce fruit. So I thought, you know, maybe I'll just use, in other words, to create a new grape, you identify the male, and that's easy. You just collect the pollen. You put a bag over the plant, and it flowers, and you collect the pollen. Easy, no problem. But you need to turn a hermaphrodite grape into a female grape for the female, and that's very tedious. You have to remove with a tweezers and a jeweler's loop, so you can even see the flower. You know, the male part of the plant, and that's called castrating the male flower, or emasculating the male flower. And I thought, you know what? This is way too much work. This is ridiculous. So what I'll do is I'll choose a female grape as the parent. So picolite is the mother, and the father is ciliegiolo.
Okay, so Italian grapes. And
Italian grapes.
And I mean, obviously you became famous for many years for your Southern Rhone variety. What pushed the interest towards Italian varieties then?
I don't know. I just love the crazy diversity of Italian grapes. They're so particular. You know, as you know, Italians have very strong opinions about everything, including what wine goes with what food. And, you know, if you dare to consume Sangiovese with something, you know, outside the area, you know, you're a heretic. So I don't know. I just love the uniqueness of the varieties.
It worked for you. It was attracting you. We're talking of the greater California, obviously. It's changing with every time there's a new variety. What varieties do you think they will work in California, maybe in 5 years or 10 years? What would be more something we will see more of?
Yeah, that's a good question. I honestly don't know. It seems that people are looking, but it's very hard to find get acceptance for a new variety. In the future, I can't tell about 5 years, but I know in 15 or 20 years, the varieties that I think are quite interesting for California are Vermentino. I think that's super, super useful. Aglianico, I think, is really interesting. You need to find grapes that do better in a warm climate, warm, dry climate. Sansot, I think, is going to have some interest. Sagrantino, I think, has got a lot of interest. I mean, the problem in California, the economics are all messed up, and it's very hard to make an inexpensive wine that's good, a good inexpensive wine that's a good value. So the niche that seems to work for some people is to make very, very expensive wine in very small quantities and sell it based on its limited production. And so, unfortunately, that generally means it's a red wine, and it's a powerful red wine.
Okay.
Americans are not quite ready for elegant red wines. They don't quite believe they're getting their money's worth when they drink an elegant wine.
Okay, and what obviously was always been one of your main tasks to make something beautiful, elegant, hence why you wanted to start with Pinot Noir at the beginning.
Yes.
And what do you think about like new producers are coming up now doing Southern Rhone grapes? And is any area that you think is doing particularly well with that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, eventually most of California figured out that it needs to be a cool site to grow Syrah. So Syrah in parts of Santa Barbara County, Santa Maria area, the Sonoma coast produce excellent Syrah. The problem in California is that the people who buy Syrah, who are willing to spend a lot of money for Syrah, you have the same problem there that you have with Italian grapes. You know, why would somebody want to buy a California Nebbiolo when they can buy a Barbaresco? Well, Barbarescos are now quite expensive, but Gamay or something like that. They can buy an excellent Nebbiolo for less money in Italy. And the same thing in France. You can buy a Saint-Joseph maybe for the less money than you pay for a California Syrah. So, and Côte Rôtie, I mean, now some Côte Rôtie are very expensive, but until recently you could buy a fabulous Côte Rôtie for the same price as a California Syrah. Why would anyone want to buy California wine?
Okay, well, that has always been one of the, but it's been one of the capping element of the grape. I mean, so it hasn't got quite the biggest reach, unfortunately. It's a beautiful grape, and I think in California it could do very well. And what I wanted to ask as well was, you were also one of the first with one of the other brand, it was the Canela Zina that you did back a few years ago. But I think it was interesting for me to see why did you decide to do it in screw cups. Why do you believe in the screw cups?
Well, I kind of backed into it by accident. I had been working with corks in 20, this is now more than 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Corks were dreadful. I mean, they're still problematic, but they were particularly bad 25 years ago. They're really dreadful. And I mean, maybe 8 or 10% of the bottles were corked. I mean, that is just ridiculous. So, and for a number of years, we went with a synthetic closure, which turned out to have its own problems that were almost as bad, virtually as bad as the corks, different problems. But I noticed that the wine writers and the sommelier were all very unhappy with corks. So they were supportive of an alternate closure. It was really the public itself that seemed to have resistance, that they've been taught that a fine wine has a cork in it. And so the issue was, technically, it was determined that screw caps were perfectly good technical closure. The issue was one of consumer acceptance. And so I thought to myself, you know what, I'll just make a splash. I'll just make sure that people accept it, because we're just going to make it happen. And it was a little, in retrospect, it was a little risky, but it worked. We did an event, a very special event, where we staged a funeral for Monsieur Thierry Bouchon. We had a coffin and a corpse made out of corks. And I was able to persuade Jancis Robinson to come to New York City and deliver a eulogy for Monsieur Bouchon. And needless to say, this was very cheeky indeed. But we got a lot of publicity about this. And the take-home lesson for me was that we imagined there was going to be a lot of resistance on the part of consumers, but it turns out there was very little resistance. Because basically people, they might have preferred their wine in cork, but it's like, you know what? I like this wine anyways, and it's got a screw cap. Okay, fine. I'll buy it with a screw cap. No big deal. So we were expecting problems that would never
open. I mean, that opened up the market. I mean, it was only first to have these the screw cap and open up the market for that. I think I don't have any particular problem with screw caps. I think they are perfectly good closures. And what is next coming up from you? What is the next project? Obviously now you're focusing on your Popolo Schum, but
yeah, I mean, Popolo Schum is the project, and I want to make a vin de terroir. I want to make wines of place, and I want to make wines that express soil characteristics. I want to make them obviously in a very hands-off, minimalist style, and I want to leave something to the world before I go. I want to leave some germplasm. I mean, at the minimum, I think if I can create something that was there, that's there, that wasn't there before, that's something interesting. I mean, just making a wine is ephemeral, but if you can create a new variety or discover a new variety or a new way of making wine, I think that potentially can make a contribution.
Leaving an imprint into the industry. And what wine Is any wine produced in the estate yet? Is anything being produced, or anything is going to come out?
We made a little bit that haven't commercialized. We made some Grenache that was extraordinary, really extraordinary. Some Grenache Blanc and Grenache Gris, very excellent. Grenache really likes San Juan Bautista. Our climatic conditions, I think, are closest in France to Roussillon. They're very similar to Roussillon. So the grapes that do well in Roussillon do well in San Juan Bautista. We've made a little bit this year of Ruque.
From north of Italy.
Yeah, from Piemonte. And I kind of worried about it because I thought maybe we were too warm. But it ripened exactly at the right time, and we were able to get a lot of flavor intensity, strangely, at a lower degree of alcohol than you find in Piemonte.
It sounds very good, and I think it's always good to experiment. And it would be a nice experience finding something that this is very good, and discovering something new, a positive experience in that. And I mean, we could continue talking for hours because of all your experiences and 30 years in wine industry in California, maybe a little bit more. Is there any particular area that do you think of California should be more talked about as a last question? There's something like an area of California you think this should be more?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think Napa has had it's plenty of exposure. I'm not sure about the up-and-coming areas. I think possibly the counties north of the North Coast, Mendocino County has a lot of potential. Lake County has a lot of potential. I'm forgetting the names of the counties up above them, but I think those cooler sites have a lot of potential. And of course, the Central Coast, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, Santa Maria area, I think have great potential. They've got problems. There's not enough water. That's a big issue. But they're cool sites. And if people could just figure out what to grow besides Pinot Noir, I mean, that's drives me crazy. I love Pinot Noir, but people should try something else besides Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. I think they'll have much better luck.
Okay. Well, we'll see with time what will happen in there. Randall, I wanted to thank you for your time. And once again, your project is called Poprushu. And thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
That was Randall Graham, founder of Poprushu and Bonny Du Vignette. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe and remember to tell your friends about it. Also be sure to go to mattiascarpazzo.com and to subscribe to the mailing list. It's the only way you can listen to the Presage, the after-interview conversation with the guest. You can find Looking Into Wines on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and every major listening app. If you enjoy the podcast, you can donate on mattiascarpazzo.com. A special thanks to today's guest, Randall Grams. Music produced by Samuele Di Nardo. Editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.